Today's Monday, October 28th, and we're having Matt Ho with us to talk about what's going on right now. And Matt, let's get started with what has happened between Iran and Israel. Israeli attack on Iran. What's your take on this attack?
My take on it right now, and then, you know, ask me in 7 or 8 days when the elections are over, because things may have really changed then. But this was actually, we're not used to seeing this, a rather wise and prudent move by Israel, not the typical kind of Netanyahu channeling Nixon and Kissinger madman escapades that we've grown accustomed to, but rather a very limited face-saving move. We have no idea about what type of damage was done. We'll probably never know what type of damage was done by the Israeli strike. I don't think the Israelis cared about that. They're saying they destroyed all types of Iranian missile defense systems, and now they can just fly over Iran whenever they want. I don't believe that. I also don't believe that they didn't do any damage either. So somewhere in between, right? But that's all beside the point. The idea of this attack really was a face-saving maneuver. We have to remember that for Israel, the priority is Palestine. And a lot of times we get ahead of ourselves. A lot of times we kind of get led by the news. We get led by the propaganda. We get led by the information operations. We get caught up in what's happening, right? The events, and we get caught up with the possibility of what may happen. And we tend to lose sight of what the realities are for these countries. And for as much as the Israeli rhetoric for decades have been about Iran, the reality is that Iran is not the priority for the Israelis. The Palestinians are the priority for the Israelis. Iran certainly is important, along with the rest of these axis of resistance, because they're supporting the Palestinians. But to say that that's a secondary or tertiary concern for the Israelis, the concern are the Palestinians. Same way, too, Iran serves as the great boogeyman. They serve as a distraction. So as long as the Israelis can point out to the world all the evil doings of the Iranians, the Israelis feel that they can get away with their occupation, their apartheid, their humiliation, their genocide of the Palestinians. And that might not be effective, excuse me, for the folks who are listening to and watching your program, or for most of the world, but it's effective for the American political and media class. It's effective for the British political and media class, as well as a few other countries. And, you know, that's the purpose of it. So I saw that this attack was keeping in line with that understanding of what's Israel's priority right now. Also with the reality that Israel's military is overstretched. And the most important reality is that the United States was not going to join in at this point. That was obviously made clear. All the reports we had coming out of Washington and Tel Aviv saying that the U.S. was going to be directly involved, we're all wrong. I think many of us got ahead of ourselves on that. We were expecting something big. I certainly did, right? And, you know, what we saw was, okay, we should have taken a step back in our analysis and recognized where we are, what's occurring, what are Israel's priorities, what do they have the capacity to do, to realize that this was going to be a limited strike, and mainly, again, to save face. Now, after the American elections, which are today's Monday, the elections are next Tuesday, in 8 days' time, the evening of the elections, things may change. And the American administration, the Biden administration, may be much more willing to join in on an Israeli attack on Iran. So I think what we saw right now was, if I dare say it, wiser, more mature move by Israel to keep themselves within the bounds of what they need to accomplish, what they need to do, remembering their priorities, remembering what type of support they can actually get from the Americans. And, you know, so I think for the Israelis, honestly, you know, we might see something different. I mean, we might see a full scale attack. I heard a commentator this morning talking about how Netanyahu views himself, if he's going to be a man of history, that in order to achieve that status, that heroic status, he has to destroy Iran's nuclear program. I don't know. I mean, nobody knows what Netanyahu is going to do. I tend to think, and maybe I'm foolish for doing so, that the Israelis will be wiser than that, and that they will continue with their current strategy of peeling apart the axis of resistance one by one, with the priority, of course, being their goal of removing Palestine, right? And whatever that looks like, right? But this idea eventually of erasure of Palestine, they're still going towards, whether it's military occupation, subjugation, and the forced assimilation of the Palestinians, or it's the out and out ethnic cleansing. I don't think anyone knows right now what path they're on. We can see what they're doing in North Gaza, and they're certainly on that latter path towards ethnic cleansing. But overall, for the West Bank, for East Jerusalem, what will their policies be? That's tied in a bit, of course, with Lebanon, right? Because this idea of southern Lebanon being part of Greater Israel, that falls into that Zionist Greater Israel project. But again, Lebanon, Hezbollah, secondary to the Palestinians. And of course, everyone understands that relationship there, right? So I think what's to come, I think if I was pressed on it, I would say that we're going to see more of the same. We're going to see more of these tit for tats between Israel and Iran. Israel feeling more confident that they will have a greater American backing if they need it, but also too understanding that destroying Iran, getting to a full-scale war with Iran, trying to kill the supreme leader of Iran is not their priority right now. 6 months from now, a year from now, 18 months, however long, very possibly. But right now, they have to finish what they're doing with Gaza, figure out what they're doing with the West Bank, and then, of course, try and do something in Lebanon, as opposed to what they're doing right now, which is actually, I shouldn't have phrased it that way, because what they're doing in Lebanon is what they want to be doing. They're making southern Lebanon uninhabitable for the Lebanese in the process of trying to degrade Hezbollah, or whatever military terms I want to use for that. The real purpose is to punish Hezbollah, punish the Lebanese people, and try and make southern Lebanon as uninhabitable as possible for the Lebanese. So I would think that's what we're going to continue to see going forward. Again, big caveat, asterisk, apologies up front, because after the elections next week, this administration, this Biden White House may say, you know what? Joe Biden's legacy is going to be the American president who finally stood up to Iran, right? Or their calculation is going to be, say, if there's a Trump White House coming in, that we don't want Trump to, in the Republic, to say we had to finish the job with Iran that the Democrats were too weak to do. The Democrats have put a lot of their platform, a lot of their campaigning, a lot of their rhetoric this past 6 months on how much tougher they are on Iran than on than the Republicans are. And I don't think that's a rhetoric, that's a campaign, that's campaigning that they're going to drop. So I think the Biden White House might say we have to stay ahead of the Republicans. We couldn't get into a war with Iran before the elections. But now with Trump coming in, we got to have these 2 months to say we attacked Iran first. We can't let the Republicans have it. And of course, if Harris is coming in, then the Biden administration, their play may be, well, this way it can't be, this way it's something that Harris inherited, that she didn't do it herself, right? So it's the best of both worlds for the Democrats as well. Harris can put, if it goes badly, Harris can push it off onto the Biden White House. If it goes well, then hey, the Democrats are really good at fighting wars and defeating enemies like Iran, you know, et cetera. So I that's what I'm afraid of, is that's how the White House is looking at this, and Joe Biden, his legacy being, he didn't beat Russia in Ukraine, but he could, you know, maybe beat down on the Ayatollah and the mullahs in Iran and try and have that as his final legacy.
When it comes to these interactions between Iran and Israel, as you mentioned, I do see as a sign of distraction from what's going on in Gaza.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to do everything. Even with Lebanon is different, but with Iran, they knew that they don't want a big conflict with Iran. But they did play with this conflict in order, in my opinion, to negotiate with the United States to get more weapons from the United States, to even the United States to convince them to send more weapons in order to be in line with their policy towards Iran.
Right.
How did you find Anthony Blinken's visit? Do you think, is that related? Who's in charge, in your opinion?
In charge of the American administration? It's not your...
No, in charge of what's going on in the Middle East, considering Iran and Israel.
I think it's a relationship that is kind of like the chicken and egg problem of which comes first. And this is decades and decades long. And even when you get to the relationship, the founding of Israel, and the replacement of Britain as the world's empire by the United States, right? The taking of that, of those, that, those interests, those responsibilities, if you will, as they would phrase it, from the Brits. Okay, now you're inheriting what the Brits are trying to do in the Middle East with a Jewish state. You know, always have to remind people, you know, the British governor general in Jerusalem in the 1930s said, what we are doing here is we are creating a loyal Jewish Ulster in the midst of a potentially hostile sea of Arabs, right? So when the World War II is over and the United States takes over the British Empire, all its interests and obligations again, they inherit that perspective. They inherit that belief. They inherit that responsibility, if you will. So, you know, trying to understand who's in charge here is difficult. But in the acute sense, in the direct sense, you certainly saw this election cycle that the Israelis are in charge, right? How that all began, again, chicken and egg problem. But like in this sense, and right now, in this past year, the Israelis have been in charge. I don't want to overstate that, though. Certainly the carrot and stick that the Israel lobby carries in the United States because of the legalized bribery system that is the American political system, no different than how the banks, big pharma, the health insurance companies, the military industrial complex, the big agriculture companies, et cetera, are all in charge of their respective industries and their respective fields. So same for the Israel lobby when it comes to the Middle East. You know, so certainly what we saw this past year was the Israel lobby ensuring that the Democratic Party understood it. So the entire election cycle, you've seen the Democrats scared to death they're going to offend the Israel lobby, and the Republicans hoping to heaven that the Democrats are going to offend the Israel lobby. And that's been the play this entire last year, has just been that the Democrats afraid to offend, the Republicans praying to God that the Democrats somehow offend the Israelis. And that has made the decision making for the White House very easy. I'm sure they went through their calculations, in terms of their political calculations. A year ago, many of us were talking about this already, what this would cost the Biden and now the Harris campaign in the elections in terms of losing not just Arab American and Muslim American votes, but progressive votes, you know, millions of votes they're going to lose because of this. The calculation to them was that the Israeli lobby is much more important, that the Israeli lobby, the money of the Israel lobby, the potentiality of that money being used against us as well as for us is too great. And then we saw what happened back in the spring, where you had this uncommitted movement in the Democratic Party, which caused a lot of commotion in the primaries. And that actually drives the Biden administration to actually start talking about ceasefires. And you see like this big, in the news, this big schism between Biden and Netanyahu, and the White House is angry, and behind closed doors, they're saying really harsh things to the Israelis, you know, on and on, and making a big show of it. And the Democrats get through the primaries. Biden, of course, steps down. Harris takes over. And at that point, it's clear to them that their play is to continue. The calculations are clear to continue with the Israel lobby, and that any potential political insurgency from the uncommitted movement, as it's called, within the Democratic Party was negligible. And we saw this play out at the Democratic Party's National Convention in August, where the Democrats refused to have anyone speak on the stage who might say anything that could be construed as not being favorable towards Israel. They had an anti-abortion Republican speak on the stage, you know, and they wouldn't have anyone who would even any type of reference to Palestine. So you saw clearly how that battle within the Democratic Party played out. The foolishness, I think, as many of us saw coming, that the Democratic Party was actually going to listen. Because, you know, the crazy thing about this, Nima, is that there are plenty of polls out there at this point now that shows that if Kamala Harris was more aggressive towards Israel, if Kamala Harris said, I am going to impose an arms embargo, or I'm going to condition military aid to Israel on a ceasefire, that she would win more votes than she would lose. It's clear, particularly in swing states, that she has to win in order to win this election. So what we're seeing then is we're seeing the Democratic Party say, we'd rather lose this election. We'd rather not get the votes we need to win rather than offend the Israeli lobby. You know, and this gets into the whole aspect of how the Democrats played this, how the Democratic National Committee made its decisions over the last year, particularly once in the springtime where it was, you know, and after that disastrous debate Biden did with Trump, you know, and the idea for the Democrats, I think, was they thought they were going to lose. That the idea was that and you hear this from Sanders, you hear this from Bernie Sanders, you hear this from AOC back in June and July, this idea that the Democrats are going to concede by having Biden drop out. And the idea, I believe, is that Biden drops out. Now we give Harris a chance. She gets a chance. We also get her out of the way because we feel like we're going to lose this. We know we're going to lose this race. And this way we sacrifice her up in 24. It protects our coming generation of leaders, Whitmer, Newsom, Buttigieg, whoever, you know, as well as it gets the money. And this big thing for the business of the Democratic Party, because this is big business, as people should be aware. I mean, these are billion-dollar campaigns. A lot of people are buying BMWs at Christmas after this election is over with the amount of money they're making on it. You know, so the idea being is that money that had stopped because Biden was not going to win comes back in because Harris is down the campaign. And I think that was the play of the Democrats. And we're not going to offend the Israel lobby. And then we'll just go, we'll run our midterms in 26 like we ran our midterms in 2018. We'll win the House, we'll win the Senate because Trump will be so awful. And then we'll be set up for victory in 28 with one of our new generation of leaders, particularly our governors. I think that was the play. You know, all that said, you also have to realize that you have true believers throughout Washington, D.C. You have true believers in Joe Biden. You have true believers in Tony Blinken and in Jake Sullivan throughout the entire executive, all throughout the relevant committees in Congress, in the politically appointed positions at the CIA, at the State Department, at the NSC, at the Department of Defense, so on and so forth. These are all men and women who really do believe in this special relationship between Israel and the United States. They really do believe that the United States should have an Israel first policy. They really do believe that American interests are aligned and intersect and conjoined with Israel's interests. So even if you didn't have, you know, I just went on a whole big thing about the Israel lobby and how, you know, in its role in this election, its dominant role in this election. Even if you didn't have that, though, you'd still have people in the White House, still have people all throughout Washington, D.C., who would be allied with Israel, who'd be supporting Israel, who believe in the purposes of what Israel is doing, because that is their world outlook. It is an outlook that is Zionist, but it's also an outlook that is imperial. This is the American empire. This is one of our vassals. This is one of our client states. People can, you know, we can argue which way the client relationship goes with Israel. But in terms of the supremacy of the American empire, this is one of ours. And we have to do everything we can to ensure its victory. So, you know, we get into this again, like I said, this chicken and egg. How do you pull it apart for this election cycle? Clearly. But I think after, you can make the argument that after the elections, why is the Biden White House then going to continue to support Netanyahu, particularly the way that they've been embarrassed, particularly because it's so clear the massive violations of human rights, the massive violations of international law, the genocide, essentially, right? As well as the fact that this relationship with Israel is hurting the U.S. strategically. It's isolating us, to make it very simple. It's destroyed any progress that these administrations claim they have in terms of the relationship with MBS and MBZ and all that and throughout the Middle East. It's hurting them. You know, so on a rational level, you look at this and say, why the heck would the White House continue to go forward? Why wouldn't they drop or at least lessen their support for the Israelis after the election? Because they don't need the Israel lobby at this point anymore. You could worry about, you know, we're about 26 later, because they really do believe in it, because they are true believers, because they are Zionists, and because they are American, that they represent the American empire, and the empire can't lose in any way, shape, or form, whether it's the United States itself or one of its proxies. So, yeah, that's how I essentially view that relationship. I'm sorry it took so long to get that all out, but I think all those points are relevant because it is complicated. It's not so simple as just pointing at one thing or another and saying that's the answer. And it's also, you know, at least with Israel, it's a decade, a century long issue. This really is the new night. When the Brits put forward the Balfour Declaration in 1917, and they have all their various reasons for doing so. Well, when the Americans take over from the British, that Balfour Declaration becomes our own, right? So to understand this, you really have to peel the layers back through that point to understand why the United States has this relationship with Israel, why we're so willing to do everything we can, including hurting our own interests to defend Israel, and of course, why we're so willing to commit a genocide.
Yeah. The other thing, Matt, J.D. Vance recently in his interview said that our priority is not Iran, a bigger war with Iran. Israel wants to have a war with Iran, but we are not interested in that. And we learned that Donald Trump again is talking about the possibility of having Mike Pompeo in his administration.
Right. God help us.
This guy is Bolton. It's the same.
He is.
And how we can understand the contradiction of these type of mindset. Pompeo is not just against Iran. I think he's against any sort of negotiations, any sort of substantial negotiations with Russia or even with China.
Yeah.
Everybody knows him by now. But right. How can we understand the future? You mentioned the Democratic Party. The alternative would be the Republican Party. What right. do we know about their candidate?
The thing about a Harris win is that a Harris loss is unfortunately a Donald Trump win, and the same thing too, right? A Donald Trump loss is unfortunately a Kamala Harris win. And it is, it's two sides of the same coin, and the details are going to be different, right? On one side, you got a thing of, you know, whoever, and on the back, you got an eagle or whatever. It's on the same coin though. It just looks a bit different. Certainly, I think who Trump brings in, and I think it's becoming clearer and clearer, and anyone who thinks that just because he's got RFK Jr. campaigning with him, that he won't drop RFK Jr. in a heartbeat. Not that RFK Jr. is anything but atrocious on the Israel-Palestine issues, but this idea that he's got Tulsi Gabbard and other people, and that somehow he's going to be more moderate, or he's going to be really, truly American first, he'll drop those people on November 6th. If it makes sense to him, that's who Donald Trump is. On the other side, though, I really do think that the Democrats will, whatever they've been offering Liz Cheney, they'll be good on it. So we may in a Harris administration have a Liz Cheney as Secretary of State or something like that. God help us, right? But the Trump administration, I think you're going to see people in the Trump administration like a Tom Cotton. You're going to see Mike Pompeo. Possibly come back. Very possibly you're going to see a Nikki Haley in a Trump administration. Certainly the people who are available to him in terms of who are on the bench for the Republican Party are all people who are, you know, different in tone and style and a little bit of their substance. And they don't think we should be spending $185 billion to kill Russians. We should be spending $185 billion to kill Chinese. You mean that's the difference? It's just, you know, there's going to be no fundamentally different approach via principle or values or theories. It's going to be the same thing. It just, you know, focusing as one nation being a bigger boogeyman than the other. I think there is the rational aspect that you do get within these administrations that, the George Bush lesson, in terms of the catastrophe of Iraq, even though he got reelected, Obama was better about the catastrophe that, you know, his escalation of the war in Afghanistan in terms of managing that and not having the political consequences. Although, of course, he had the political consequence in 2010, and that was enough for the rest of his presidency when the Democratic Party lost 1,000 seats across the country. 2 years after Obama was elected. With this Trump administration, I think we've seen it before. I think there's no shortage of retired generals who will step in and fill the role that, say, John Kelly filled. John Kelly, the Marine Corps four-star general who was Trump's first chief of staff. I don't know what is so fundamentally different about what Trump is saying now than what he was saying in 2015 and 2016. Trump was already telling us who he was going to be. And the frustration, if I remember correctly, from the generals that were in Trump's administration, Kelly as chief of staff, Mattis as secretary of defense, H.R. McMaster as national security advisor, was he wasn't doing enough. He wasn't waging war hard enough. There wasn't a concern about his view on civil liberties. There wasn't his concern about his view on democracy. And he was clearly saying these types of things even then. So I don't see this. The commentary that's coming out now, I don't find to be trustworthy. Regardless, Trump can find people to fill in these roles, and it will be an imperial presidency. It will be an imperial outlook. Again, it'll just be different in terms of where do they want to focus on. Vance is a smart guy. He's incredibly opportunistic. He has no real foundation to him. He's incredibly transactional. I think that's why Donald Trump likes him so much. He sees himself in J.D. Vance, right? That opportunity, that transaction. But Vance is, you can't deny he's a smart guy, and he can look at this and see that a war with Iran doesn't make sense. What do we get out of it? You know, what's particularly if he's briefed on what the potentialities are in terms of the thousands of missiles that would be exchanged throughout the region. And if your priority is China, why are you going to send the American Navy what little we have of it? Because the American Navy exists on paper quite nicely, but in reality, they can barely even refuel their own ships at sea. So we're going to send them all what, to the Persian Gulf again? To what, kill Iranians for what purpose? To maybe kill a supreme leader? Maybe, but for what purpose? You know, and then the results being a world economic shock because of that war, a recession that you're going to have to deal with, that you're going to be blamed for. And then very likely or possibly you see Tel Aviv reduced to smoldering ruins from 25,000 missiles fired onto it or something like that. You know, I mean, that might be some hyperbole there and exaggeration. But, you know, for anyone who is a smart person, it just doesn't add up. I think very much like the Israelis, like my estimation of the Israelis, is analysis of the Israelis, they want the war with Iran to continue in this limited manner. They want the tit for tat. They want to try and manage it. They, you know, remember before October 7th, the Israelis were assassinating Iranian scientists. They were launching cyber attacks on Iran. And they were hijacking Iranian ships. I mean, there's a lot of tension there, but it was all kind of kept at that lower level. And that's enough, though, to continue the American support. And I think that's what the Republicans want and the Democrats, too. Not forgetting what I just said about the Biden White House, maybe seeing this as a way to burnish the old man's legacy. But this idea that we just want to keep it on a low flame. We want to keep it gently boiling, you know, simmering. We don't want it to get too big because this is good theater for us. It's good politics for us. The military industrial complex is really happy. I mean, they love the thing in the Red Sea, even though it should be an entire embarrassment that the U.S. Navy has utterly failed. They've lost the war, the great battle of the Red Sea. The American Navy said plenty of times, this is the largest naval battle since World War II, and they've lost it because half of commercial ships are still avoiding the Red Sea. But they do like it because I think they're confident that unless something goes wrong or unless things dramatically escalate and the Russians give advanced missiles to the Yemenis, they'll be able to shoot everything down. They won't have any casualties. And then they're all going to get awards. All the admirals and captains and commanders will get a new row of ribbons on their chests, all that type of stuff. The military industrial complex likes it because we are spending so much money shooting missiles, shooting down these drones, firing missiles into sand dunes in Yemen or whatever the heck we're doing, you know, and they like it because everyone's getting their chance. They're all getting something out of it. The gig is good, right? It's a great grift. You know, these ships, the Navy, we're getting combat experience, largest battle since World War II. No one's asking us if we're winning it or not, but largest battle since World War II. And of course, the military industrial complex. Yeah. Hey, how many more of those missiles do you need? Right. You know, I mean, so I think if they could get that on the Iranian level and keep it, they'd be happy with it. But, you know, that's something they have to manage. And I have no confidence that the Republicans could manage a situation like that, no more than I don't think the Democrats could do, because look at this position we're in. You know, we're all, what we're, comes back to again, Nima, is this idea that we're depending upon Netanyahu to be rational and deliberate in his actions. To everything I said earlier about how Iran is not their primary concern, that the priority is the Palestinians, that's a rational approach to that, is this. You know, and so, I mean, completely upending everything I'm saying, because we're relying on Netanyahu to act that way, right? And so that's where you're going to predicate, that's where you're going to have to build your whole Middle Eastern policy on the actions of Netanyahu, on his decision-making, right? I mean, so, because even when everything I say about the Israelis, the priority being the Palestinians, it's clear that Netanyahu also has an obsession with Iran, right? And so, yeah, I mean, so ultimately, I don't see the Republicans being any different than the Democrats. And I think the main thing that keeps them in check is the same thing that kept the Democrats in check this past year, the fear of the economic consequences. If you do this, if you do go after Iran, you try and kill their supreme leader, you bomb their nuclear facilities, you bomb their oil facilities, they shut the Strait of Hormuz down, as they say they will, the world is going to go into recession and you're going to be blamed for it, Mr. President. That's the, so I think that's what's keeping us, that's what's keeping the American administrations in check. You know, so now you could make the point that to them and like, you know, hey, if you had, you know, really pushed on renewable energies 20 years ago, maybe it wouldn't matter so much, but I think that point would be lost on them.
When you look at Donald Trump today, Matt, do you think that, how do you see the changes happening in him, comparing him with what he was in his first term? It seems to me that the guy is totally different from what we've seen in those days. He's calm right now. He's thinking more. I think he's ready to make some compromise and cooperation with the Republican Party. That's why we're hearing from Nikki Haley. We're hearing from Mike Pompeo. This is the problem. Those people who are these MAGA and MAGA they're talking about, yeah. I don't think that they're going to achieve anything through Donald Trump. It's a big lie out there.
I don't think so either. I don't think so either. The MAGA for him is simply the votes to get him into office. That's all it is. So he plays to that. He understands that. In 2015, 2016, he had a run as an insurgent candidate. You know, in the summer of 2015, when he really starts to run, everyone's laughing at him. You know, and many people, myself included, didn't think he had any chance. I mean, he was running against 15 other candidates in the Republican primary, many of them well-accomplished politicians, you know, career politicians, people who have won governorships and Senate races, right? And had a lot of money behind them and have family names behind them like Bush, you know, I mean, so he defeats them all. And then it's kind of like, I was in Okinawa. And in September of 2016, and talking to these two Polish ladies, and they're asking about this, and I was like, yeah, it was really impressive what he did. He defeated the Republicans, but now he's up against the Clinton machine. It's just like it's really just waiting for the coronation to occur with Clinton at this point. Yeah, and he beat Clinton. Every one of us was wrong about that, you know, including most of the people on his side. If you talk to folks who are in that community, that Trump community. They'll tell you they had no transition plan. They had, right? I mean, they really, you know, this is what they'll say. This is why we brought on people like, you know, these neocons, because we had nobody else, because nobody thought Trump was going to win. This is what they'll tell you, you know? And this time they're confident they're going to win. He just needs the votes from the MAGA folks. And he also has to realize that he can't be with that at war within the Republican Party the way he was in the first administration. So where he had that really tense relationship with Mitch McConnell, say in his first term, He can't have that now. If he wants to get done the things he wants to get done, if he wants to honor the promises he made, if he wants to realize his ambitions, you know, and I think those ambitions really are tax cuts for the rich and deregulation of industry, and you know, maybe a couple other things. But I think that's two big agenda items he has, and everything else he wants to manage and not make his life difficult. You know, I mean, so. You know, he's in a different place than he was 8 years ago. He's in a different place than he was 4 years ago. But I think you're right. I think once he gets into office, if he gets into office, and I think he's likely going to win. I think the if the polls are off the way they've been off, the way they were off in 2016, where they're off in 2020, well, then it's not a tied race right now. It's Trump up by 3 or 4. You know, and I don't have any confidence that polls are any better than they were in 2016 or 2020. So I tend to think, based on that alone, Trump is going to win. And, you know, if he does win, if he's in office, you know, I think, as you said, he wants to get things done. He wants to accomplish things. He wants to make good on what he says, not because I think he wants to honor any commitments, but because I think he has a desire to be proven right, a desire to see his vision enacted right, and to prove wrong those who right, as well as to stick it to people. So I think there's a lot of that. But yeah, we are looking at a different Trump in many ways than we did in 2016. At the same time, too, though, as I just said before, you know, he is the same person. His attitude toward things. I mean, he said, "I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and everyone would still vote for me." That's still fundamentally who he is. And if that's not a fascist statement, I don't know what's a fascist statement. The other, you know, I mean, so yeah. So we're gonna see, you know, what's gonna occur in a week's time. It's gonna be really contentious, really awful. You know, definitely say a prayer, light a candle for the United States in the next couple of months, in the sense that we don't have problems that cause problems for other people. I know people. A lot of schadenfreude out there. People are happy to see the United States go through this. Look, whether it's Harris or Trump, the United States is getting the president that we deserve. That's clear, right? The problem is that we are the world's imperial power. And if things go badly for us, things are going to go badly for other nations as well. You know, so this idea of a catastrophic American collapse, it's not good for the rest of the world. You know, the American empire needs to go. American empire is in decline, but it'd be much better if it went through a smooth, gradual decline than an abrupt collapse. Because I've said this to you before, right, Nima, like this idea, a dying mule kicks hardest. And, you know, that's this idea, too, with Israel, this idea of people wanting to see Israel collapse. And certainly, you know, the Israeli state, it needs to go away and it needs to be replaced by something that is democratic. Not a threat to others, that is not racist and apartheid, you know, and so forth. And the Palestinians need to have their own state and so forth. But this idea of a dramatic Israeli collapse through a civil war or whatever, as I think I understand the idea why people are supportive of that, the emotion behind that, you have to realize what that would mean to the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people will get the worst of any of that. So however bad things go for Israel in the future, it's only going to be harder on the Palestinians. And it's not saying that things shouldn't go bad for Israel, won't go bad for Israel. We shouldn't do our best to bring about the end of that apartheid regime, the end of that occupation. But we just have to keep in mind that when things like that happen, a people under occupation like the Palestinians and under that close proximity, so it's not like there's some faraway territory right there, that this is where the anger, the hate, the reaction to a collapse in Israel is going to be directed at. It's going to be directed on the Palestinians. So we have to keep that in mind, just as they have to keep in mind bad things happening to the Americans. They will try and redirect that onto others.
And considering what's going on between Israel and Lebanon, Matt, do you think it, as we know, that the casualties on the part of Israelis is increasing right now as we talk in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And as they're having this battle in the southern part of Lebanon, at the same time, they're targeting some civilian infrastructure, some civilian buildings in Beirut.
Yeah.
When you put these two pictures together, why they're not, first of all, what are they not fighting on the battlefield the way that Hezbollah is doing this? What's the necessity of hitting some targets in Beirut? Seems mm-hmm. They're killing mostly civilians.
Well, for the Israelis, killing civilians is a legitimate military objective. I mean, it's enshrined under the Dahiya doctrine, Dahiya, the neighborhood of Beirut that's being just brutalized this last month and a half or so. It takes its name because that's what the Israelis did in 06 when they invaded Lebanon. And it's not the idea, the theory is that you're going to hurt the civilian population so badly that they're going to give up, essentially, that they're either going to the armed wing, the government, whatever, is going to say, our people are hurting too badly, we have to stop, or the people are going to say, you have to stop, we're hurting too badly. It's completely, I want to say completely ahistoric, but it's mostly ahistoric. There's hardly any evidence to support something like that working. So what's the reason why the Israelis, and the Israelis like talking about it, sounds, right? It sounds most like they're being magnanimous, right? I mean, it sounds almost like they're being, charitable, you know, in how they're carrying it out. We're going to give the people on the other side the option whether they want to have this continue or not, right? I mean, but so it's more PR than anything else. But the prime reason for it, the prime purpose for it is that punishment, brutalization, subjugation, those are all legitimate military objectives because that's the way Israel conducts war. It has always conducted war that way. Terror, the use of that against civilians has been a prime mode of operation for the Israelis going back before Israel was a nation. I mean, certainly during the British mandate, the use of terrorism against the Brits, the bombing of the King David Hotel in 1946, 47, whenever that occurred, that's often cited as the first act of modern terrorism, you know, the post-World War II modern era. So this is who the Israelis are. And this is why this idea of even, say, war with Iran, what type of strategic objectives could you actually get out of this? What's actually going to change? Well, nothing other than we're putting punishment on our enemies. And that's what we do. And again, if you have the supremacist mindset, as the Israelis do, this Jewish supremacist mindset, then in your enemy is Amalek, going back to the Bible, and that they are subhuman, that they are the other, that they are on, that you have been directed by God to extinguish them, then of course you should just be killing them for the sake of killing them, right? So you really, really vile, really harsh how the Israelis conduct their war. Because again, they see the killing of civilians as having the same military necessity as the destruction of the enemy's military forces. In many ways, they see that as an objective itself, the punishment, the beating down, this idea that you are going to desolate them. Now, what we're seeing in Lebanon, of course, is that occurring. There's an element of when you are the imperial power in the region, just to put it like kind of in those terms, with regards to Israel, and someone acts up against you, this is what you have to do. If you're the colonizer, you have to subjugate the colonized. And that's how Israel sees itself, not just within its own boundaries, not within just the occupied territories of Palestine, but also as well throughout the region. So you have this supremacist colonist mindset married up with a way that the Israelis have always carried out their military operations. And so you see, this is why they level residential buildings. They're able to get away with it because they prepared for this. They've had a media and political operation for decades now that allow them to get away with this in the United States, in Britain, and in a few other places, the places that matter to Israel. What we're seeing in southern Lebanon is that they have supposedly five divisions on the border. These are mostly mobilized reservists. This is, you don't usually mobilize someone like that, a force like that, and then not use them. The idea in Lebanon, though, in southern Lebanon, is this idea that they are trying to make the land uninhabitable for Lebanese. So the million plus Lebanese who have been displaced, there's nowhere left for them to go back to. This gets into the idea of that we're going to create a buffer zone in southern Lebanon, that we are going to expand greater Israel into southern Lebanon. So, I mean, depending upon who the audience is in Israel, who the actors are in Israel, this appeals to them for whatever reason. That, you know, whether it's just a militarist type of we need a security zone, whether it's a Zionist colonist thing of we have to take this because it's part of greater Israel, whether it's some type of strategic type of we are pushing in there and we're going to unsettle Lebanon. We're going to cause the semi-dormant fractures within Lebanon to reappear, and there's going to be a civil war, and that's going to completely remove Hezbollah from power, and Lebanon will now be in our camp. You know, I mean, appeals to those people. I mean, so you see all this, and then of course the go always have to come back to the Israeli domestic political reasons for this. Certainly Netanyahu's popularity has gone up since they killed Hassan Nasrallah. The fact that the operation in Lebanon, just like the operation, you know, war with Iran, distracts from what's happening with the Palestinians, whether it's to cover up your genocide or to make people not ask about what's happening with the hostages, right? I mean, so there's all these purposes, and you see that it's politically beneficial, this war in Lebanon, for the governing coalition. If elections are held today, I haven't seen this in probably 3 weeks now. So if I'm incorrect, someone please correct me in the comments. But as far as I know, if elections were held in Israel today, Netanyahu and his coalition remains in power. You know, there's a lot of benefit to this. And there's some kind of like theory you can put behind it. It appeals to people with different ideas. Again, either the militarists, the nationalists, the strategists, the Zionists. And to go slow, destroy everything you touch in Lebanon, make it uninhabitable. And, you know, whether how much you actually kill and degrade and destroy Hezbollah as a fighting force, I think is ultimately insignificant, because it's a political gesture that's being made. Well, I shouldn't say that political, because there are, again, territorial designs that they have. But, you know, the idea that they're going to defeat Hezbollah and they're going to raise their white flag is as absurd as that they're going to defeat Hamas and Hamas is going to raise the white flag. So a variety of things going on there. Certainly they're going in on the ground against Hezbollah. They're going into Hezbollah's strength. They've lost. They've had many casualties, you know, insignificant casualties compared to, say, Hezbollah's casualties, right? If you look at it, they don't match up. But also, too, you have to remember Israel as a reserve army. It's entering into a foreign war. It's been more than a year since this war started. The Israeli economy is bleeding out. The hostages aren't home. People can't go back, you know, to their homes in northern Israel. They can get hundreds of thousands of people out on the street to protest for Netanyahu's arrest. You know, so even though the coalition can win again today, in 4 weeks' time, they may not be able to win again, right? So it's still, even though it's been politically beneficial, it's still precarious. So I this going slow approach, I think, is wise by the Israelis, you know, as they continue their, you know, criminal invasion of Lebanon.
Before wrapping up, Matt, how do you find right now, we know that the heads of CIA and Mossad are talking with Qataris about the conflict in Gaza. In your opinion, considering not having Hamas forces and nobody, we don't know if there is a representative from Hamas participating in these negotiations or not, but it seems we don't have any sort of representative in these negotiations. How do you find it right now? What are they trying to do? Because we know that Bill Burns is not a regular, is not somebody, he wants to achieve something there. What the main reason for these negotiations? Is it possible to get some sort of ceasefire before 2024 presidential election, which is so close?
Yeah, I think they tried that over the summer, I think, or they at least made the statements. The Israelis called out Tony Blinken on this back in August. People remember there was another round of, oh, we're close to a ceasefire. Blinken was in Israel, you know, and the ceasefire is just days away. And the Israelis, you know, basically said, we don't know what he's talking about. Or actually, they said they didn't know what he was talking about. He says he's just making this up. It's all about trying to get good news before the Democratic National Convention to make sure, you know, this idea that people are going to have hope that there's a ceasefire that Kamala Harris is going to announce from the podium. You know, that didn't happen. There's never been legitimate and honest discussions for a ceasefire in the last 10 months. I mean, you had a successful ceasefire in the middle of November last year. So 11 months ago, less than 11 months, I mean, more than 11 months ago. And, you know, there's not been any desire on the Israeli part. You know, it's gone through the motions. They send their negotiators. They kill Hamas's negotiators. They make the White House and the U.S. State Department spin around like tops. They get the U.S. mission in the United General Assembly to just say these just incredibly absurd and Orwellian things in order to defend Israel. You know, I mean, it's all just a show. It's all just political theater. It's all just a game to them. And the Americans go along with it. The Americans know this is a game, and they're doing their best to play their part as well as to play off the politics of it. I don't think there's any possibility of a ceasefire before the election. I don't think it would have any, it wouldn't matter anyway at this point. You know, so that political utility to the U.S. is gone. I mean, we heard this back in August or September from a couple of sources that there is no more possibility for a ceasefire. Even though it was all a sham from the Israeli side, now it's really over. So what they're actually trying to accomplish, and we're seeing people attempting, the Egyptians put forward a 2-day ceasefire that Hamas, I believe, has accepted. The Israelis said no. I mean, the Israelis are not going to be finished with the Palestinians until the Israelis are finished with the Palestinians. That's it. And they're going to carry out their plans there. And that's it. There will be any type of I don't understand why there would be any type of hostage negotiation at this point. The hostages in Hamas's hands, the Israelis, I obviously feel, are more politically useful to them there than coming home. If the hostages come home, you got to stop this thing. It's really difficult to understand what the heck they're actually doing, other than continuing the communications, other than just kind of keeping the talks going for the sake of keeping the talks going. And who actually knows what the CIA and Mossad are actually talking about, you know? I don't know, Nima, but I can't imagine we'll see any kind of ceasefire. I think the Israelis are just going to continue with it until they're done with it, until they achieve some degree of what they want. And then maybe in a year's time or something like that, they will say, because here's the thing, they know their people are being taken care of, right? And they've seen hostages throughout the region. I mean, you had hostages in Lebanon for years, and those people, some were killed. But you know, for the most part, those people are returned, and it's terrible for the hostages and their family. It's terrible for the Israeli hostages and their family, right? I mean, so, but I think the Israeli government understands that Hamas is not going to execute these people. And so that eventually, maybe a year down the road, we'll broker a hostage negotiation, but not until we've got things set the way we want it set. So they'll have whatever they've done, whatever they're going to do in northern Gaza, the ethnic cleansing, whatever they're going to do in terms of continuing to further segregate the Gaza Strip, whatever they're going to do, you know, in terms of trying to control the Palestinian population. They'll accomplish all that. And then they may say at that point, we'll negotiate, you know, and these poor people may be held hostage for 2, 3, 4 years. Who knows? That's not the wrong possibility. And certainly that's the way the Israelis, I think, look at it. So, you know, hopefully I'm wrong. Hopefully next week, you know, it's like, hell, man, we're talking about the ceasefire deal. I would love that. I would love to be wrong and to see an end to this death, this destruction, an end to this genocide. But I don't believe that's going to happen, because Israelis aren't going to be done until Israelis aren't going to be done. And no one can change that. And that's why this whole thing about the Palestinians is so heartbreaking, because there is no hope for them. Where is the hope coming from? Where is the Deus Ex Machina? Who's descending from the clouds to support these people, to help these people? No matter what happens on November 5th, the story remains the same for the Palestinians. You know, and I think that's what we'll see. I think that's what we'll see.
Thank you so much, Matt, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Nima.
Nope.